Les colloques du Collège de France.
So thanks a lot for organizing this conference and for asking me to give this presentation, which I entitled "Should We Fear AI?" So here is the front cover of a report on AI that we produced for the French president last year. There is an English translation of the report, which can be made available easily. So I don't need to tell you that AI first developed in the form of deductive rules, if something, then something. That's what we call the symbolic approach that started in the late 1950s, based on reasoning and instruction. But as of the 1990s, particularly with the advent of machine learning, the symbolic approach has given way to the what we call the statistical approach to AI. Unlike the symbolic approach, the statistical approach involved no explicit human instruction. The machine is trained to recognize links from a set of training data, and the machine then applies these links to new data to perform a task. So the success of the statistical approach, which is now the dominant approach, relies on two essential ingredients: data and computing power. Okay? So now the AI revolution is a true technological revolution, a new general purpose technology, in the sense that it affects all domains of activity: the economy, public services, the organization of work, media, culture. And within the AI revolution, the emergence of generative AI represents an unprecedented acceleration. Just to give you an idea, it took 2.5 years for Netflix to reach 1 million users. It took 2.5 months for Instagram to reach 1 million users. It took only 5 days for ChatGPT to reach 1 million users. So now on AI and the economic impacts of AI, I would say there are two views. One is like very pessimistic, is to say essentially AI will have essentially no growth impact or very little growth impact, and a very negative employment impact. And the view that I and my colleagues and my co-authors are pushing is that AI is, I would call it cautiously optimistic, is that AI has a growth potential, and it also has employment creation potential, but whether or not this potential will be harnessed, it depends on institutions and policies. So if we put the right institutions and policies, we can harness the growth and employment potential. But technologically, it has potential. Of course, the outcome, the human growth outcome, is always the joint result of technology and institutions. But technologically, AI has enormous potential. It's incumbent on us to put the right policies and institutions to truly harness the potential of AI. Okay, so I'll talk first mainly on AI and growth, and I will also touch upon AI and employment, although Simon Bunel this afternoon will go in much more detail into the employment. I must say that to a large extent this lecture has been prepared with Simon, co-author, but voilà. So this, you could see this as the first part, and Simon in this afternoon as the elaborating on the second part. Okay, so on AI and growth, we wrote a paper for a conference volume with Chad Jones and Ben Jones, which was published in, I think, 2019, I think, and where we emphasize the fact that, you know, AI should boost productivity growth because it automates both tasks in the production of goods and services, but it also automates tasks in the production of ideas. Okay, so in particular, AI helps find solutions to complex problems, it facilitates imitation and learning, and it can become self-improving. So one way, I mean, and Chad will elaborate, so also it's complementary to Chad's lecture this afternoon, but with Chad and Ben, you could look at the basic automation model, which is a model by Joseph Zira. So here is a Cobb Douglas technology. You produce with inputs, and the inputs X can be, although you could call them tasks as well, you could say if the task or input is not automated, it's labor, and if it's automated, it's physical capital. So when you automate, you can replace labor by physical capital, which you can supply as much as you want, whereas skilled labor, you cannot supply as much as you want, okay. So now if you call capital L the sum of the LIs and capital K the sum of the KIs, at the end of the day, you end up with a production function like this, and therefore the growth of per capita GDP is GA over 1 minus alpha. But when you automate more tasks in the production of goods and services, the alpha will go up. When you automate tasks in the production of ideas, GA will go up. You see? So you have both sources of growth, okay? So AI will increase both alpha, because you automate tasks in the production of goods and services, but you also increase GA. You make ideas easier to find. I never believe that ideas are harder to find, by the way. Incidentally, personally, I think ideas are harder to find on any particular domain, but you always have new domain. You always reset. It's like in economics. Every particular field of economics goes up and down, but you always have new fields in economics. So I never believe, personally, that overall ideas are harder to find. But with AI, even less ideas will be harder to find. Okay. So you have these two sources of growth. You automate tasks in the production of goods and services, but you also automate tasks in the production of ideas. And so you have, and that might be where AI is departs from previous technological revolution. Previous technological revolution mainly automated tasks in the production of goods and services would increase the alpha, but not so much the GA. And that's what's new with AI. Okay, so as first piece of evidence, there is this paper by Brynjolfsson that just came out in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, where they look at the effect of introducing generative AI on the productivity of a US Fortune 500 company that advises SMEs on the adoption of enterprise software. So you're a small and medium-sized enterprise, you make a call to this US firm and you say, you know, I would like to know how I install a new software. And then you would be directed to employees all over the world. There are employees in the Philippines in particular. And the employee in the Philippines would tell you how you adopt the software. And one way to measure productivity is to look at the number of resolutions per hour or per day that this Philippine employee would be able to perform. And what they show, they compare the productivity of an employee after the employee has access to ChatGPT with the productivity of a similar employee in education, age, experience, of an employee that hasn't yet have access to ChatGPT. And they show that the productivity is boosted by 14% after 1 month, and after 2-3 months, it goes up to 25%. So you see, you have a significant boost in productivity for those employees in that firm that access ChatGPT compared to similar employees that do not access. Also, one thing they show, which echoes what was shown in the previous presentation, is that it's the least productive and the least experienced workers in that firm that benefit most from the introduction of ChatGPT. Okay, so that's the Brynjolfsson, but that's a very micro study. And then the thing is, how do you go from micro to macro? And of course, one way would be to say, let's just extrapolate from previous general purpose technologies. For example, electricity and IT. Another way is to adopt a task-based approach, okay? So if you just extrapolate, what happened when you had the electricity revolution in the 1920s in the US, what happened when the general purpose technology took off in the logistic rise of the curve? You know, what happened is that productivity growth went up by 1.3 percentage points per year for a 10-year period. So if you are growing at 1% per year prior to the takeoff of the electricity revolution, for 10 years you grow at 2.3, and then you get back at 1%. Okay, so that's the electricity. The IT, it was 0.8 percentage point. If you grow at 1% per year prior to the takeoff of the IT revolution, which was between 1995 and 2005, then for 10 years you grow at 1.8 and then you go back to 1. Okay, so it looks very much like this. You grow faster for 10 years and then you grow at the same rate as if the technological revolution had not occurred. So if you say, well, AI is in the ballpark of previous technological revolution, you would say it would induce an increase in productivity growth by something between 0.8 and 1.3 percentage point for 10 years. And you say, well, AI would be something between 0.8 and 1.3, okay? And so that's just extrapolating, but you say, well, why should I believe that AI would be looking like previous technological revolutions? So then the alternative is to say, well, let's adopt a task-based approach. So that's what Acemoglu, in a paper last year that's published in Economic Policy, And based on the task-based model that he developed with Restrepo, to say, well, you know, I will go directly and I will decompose, since I know that AI automates tasks in the production of goods and services, let's look at the detail of that. And from that, I infer how much TFP growth increase I expect from AI. So they would say, well, you know, the TFP gain over 10 years, it would all depend on the GDP share of tasks that are exposed to AI. Then among those tasks that are exposed to AI, what are the share of tasks for which it is profitable to implement AI? What is the labor share on those? And then what is the labor cost saving enabled by AI? And so it would be the product of four terms. Then reading the existing empirical literature, Daron puts numbers on each of those numbers, and it arrived at a 0.07, which is 10 times less than the IT revolution. You say instead, you know, I would expect that the AI revolution would increase growth by 0.07 percentage point for 10 years, or 10 times less than the IT, quoi. Okay? So with Simon, we went back to the thing and we looked at each of the figures. So the GDP share of tasks, Daron took a kind of low number from Elundu et al. But for example, IMF, you know, they say, well, you know, they assess 60% of tasks in the US on average in developed economies, and 68% of tasks in the UK are exposed to AI. So the interval to consider would be anything between 19% and 68%. So you have that's a very wide range. Okay, so why take the most pessimistic view there? Okay, so then if within the tasks that are exposed to AI, I want to look at the share of tasks for which it is profitable to use AI. And then what Acemoglu does is that he said, I look at a paper by Svanberg, and at today's cost, 23% of visual tasks exposed to AI would be profitable to automate, okay? But the thing is that this assumes zero cost reduction in AI implementation over the next 10 years. So, but we know that there is technical progress, and Svanberg et al. Themselves propose different scenarios of annual cost reduction of 10%, 20%, and 50% per year, leading respectively to a 30%, 50%, and 80% of visual tasks exposed to AI that would become profitable to automate by 1940. So the interval to consider is anything between 23% and 80%, not necessarily 23%. And still, here we just concentrate on visual tasks. You see here, you look at, you know, how worse we are compared to human performance and how fast we catch up with human performance. So that's the visual task. But there are tasks for which the catching up with human performance is much faster, okay? So for example, understanding writing or language, the progress is much faster than in visual tasks. So even just to concentrate on visual tasks, it's kind of underestimate, you see? So even the 80% might even be an underestimate. So you see the wide range you have there. And then you look at the labor cost saving enabled by AI. So what Daron does, he does the average between 40% from a paper by Noy and Zhang, and the 14% that I remember we got from the 14% that we had here. But remember that very quickly you move up to from 14 to 25%. So if you want to look in the longer term, it's the 25% that you should take, not the 14%. And therefore, it's anything in the range of 33 and 40% that you should consider. So overall, in fact, you could get anything between 0.7 or 0.08 and 1.24 percentage point. And with Simon, we argue that a good median is 0.68. So that's very much in the same ballpark, 10 times as much as Daron. And we believe it's in the same ballpark as IT. We think that AI, just looking at AI automating tasks in the production of goods and services, we get something very much in the same ballpark as IT. And just note that so far, I have not talked about the fact that AI automate tasks in the production of new ideas, okay? So there was a paper recently by a MIT student that pretend to show enormous effect of AI. Unfortunately, it was all wrong. The firm was even invented. It got an R&R in the queue. I don't know how they did that. It turned out that the paper was fake And the firm was fake, and everything was fake there. But it's a pity, because it would have been... But still, I believe in the fact we are working on evidence that to the effect that AI automate tasks in the production of ideas, not just services. So in fact, that's true, instead of having, if we just looked at automation of goods and services, you would get no AI, the dotted. The red curve would be that just increased growth by 0.68 for 10 years, and then you go back to before. But because you automate also tasks in the production of ideas, you make the innovation technology permanently better, and so you would move from the red line to the blue line, okay? And it would be like this. Permanently, you would grow, you would have a steeper line here than you would have without AI, okay? So just there to show you, so that's from Antonin. Antonin looked at the world patents that cite AI papers, and what first Antonin showed is that there's been a surge in the number of patents that cite AI papers. So that's a very important thing. The AI really pushed the production of patents. And what's very interesting is that what Antonin did as well is to look at the quality of patents that cite AI papers. And all dimensions, be it citations, be it novelty, generality, originality, the patents that cite AI papers seems to be much better patents. So now if we move from there to growth, usually when you generate more important patents, you tend to grow, to have faster productivity growth. But that's now we are in the process of looking at the effect of AI on patent production and the quality of patent production. Since now we think we have instruments for AI adoption, we can look at firms that adopt AI, what will be the effect on the amount and quality of patents they generate. Okay, so, sorry, yeah. You want to see that? Yeah, okay, thank you, that's very good. Okay, good. So now that's on the optimistic side. Optimistic side, I truly believe that AI has more growth potential than other colleagues believe, okay? Technologically, the 0.68 is a lower bound to the growth potential of AI. Now, the problem is institutional. That means that, and in particular, the lack of competition may be a problem. In joint work with Timo Bopart, Antonin, Timo Bopart, Pete Clino, and Yui Li, called A Theory of Falling Growth and Rising Rents in the River Economic Studies, we try to explain the decline in productivity growth in the US in the recent period. So what you can see here is that the average annual rate of TFP growth has soared up between 1995 and 2005. That's the IT revolution I was mentioning. But then it went down a lot since 2005. And why is that? What we argue in that paper is that with the IT revolution, you had the emergence of superstar firms. And that has been well analyzed by Autor et al. In the QJE paper. What you can see is that whether you look at services, but you know, though in other sectors, concentration has gone up a lot in the 1990s. So what happened is that the IT revolution was carried by these firms that became superstar firms. They, through merger and acquisitions, they became very dominant. Here, if you look at average markup in the US, you see that the average markup is the red curve is going up, but not so much because within firm it goes up. That's the blue curve is the within firm markup. We don't see any upward trend in the within firm markup. It's a composition effect, as the black curve is the high markup firms that were the superstar firm became increasingly pervasive. So there is a story that with the IT revolution, this firm could grow with unboundedly through merger and acquisition and things. And eventually what happened is that they discourage entry by new firms. If you look at the rate of entry of firms of all size, since the 2000, the entry rate has gone down. So we believe that very much the growth decline has a lot to do with the fact that these superstar firms have somehow discouraged entry of new firms. And why? So what happened is that you had the IT revolution, but competition policy did not adapt to the IT revolution. For example, Richard Gilbert from Berkeley has written a whole book explaining that competition policy in the US is too much static, market share, market definition, not sufficiently dynamic. Usually when allowing or not, when deciding whether or not to allow a merger and acquisition, you should look at the dynamic effects it has on future entry, future innovation. That's not what has been done. You could look at data sharing. You could look at all those things. And there is this obsession with static criteria like market share, market division. The European competition policy suffers from the same problem. So the idea there is to say, well, the IT revolution had enormous growth potential, but competition policy did not adapt to the revolution. And that's why this potential has been inhibited. Why do I mention that about AI? Because if you look at AI, if you look particularly at the upstream segments in the AI value chain, they are dominated by few firms. You only have three firms, mainly three firms in the cloud: Amazon, Google, Microsoft. You have essentially one big actor, GPU, on the market for graphic processes. So the problem is that the upstream segments of AI are dominated by few firms, and that might inhibit the growth potential that I was mentioning before. So that has consequences. I will mention before, we advocate in the report open source. We advocate not too many regulations like we have in Europe, because when you have too many regulations, the large firms know how to cope with them, but the small firms, they don't. We want the Digital Market Act, which is data sharing, to be extended to the whole value chain of AI. So we think there are all these dimensions of competition policy which are very important if we want to harness the growth potential. So overall, technologically speaking, I'm more optimistic than Darren, but where the optimism is measured is the fact that we believe that we need that institutions, in particular competition policy, should adapt to the revolution to fully take advantage of this of the growth potential that it can deliver. Okay, so that's on the growth part. Antonin, how much more do I have?
10 minutes.
Okay, that I will go fast because here I just touch upon the AI and employment because Simon will devote his presentation to that. But just to give you an idea, because again, the idea that there is potential, but you need the right institutions. So, in joint work with Céline Antonin, Simon, and Xavier Jaravel on the effects of robotization and automation on labor market, on labor demand, we were looking at, we had a comprehensive set of US of French firms, and we compare the evolution of employment in a firm that automates to the evolution of employment of a similar firm that does not automate. We do a diff-in-diff here, but then we have IV and all that, but I don't want to go into this paper in detail. But what we found is that firms that automate, they create employment, okay? And you could look at various measures, because people would say, well, is your measure industrial equipment or your automation? Well, you know, it's the same if I take robots, it's the same if I take an Acemoglu Restrepo Review of Economic Studies measure. So, voilà. Any measure you try, always you find that the employment goes up. And why is it that employment goes up? It's because you have a productivity effect. Firms that automate, that robotize, they become more productive, therefore more competitive, and therefore the world market demand for their product goes up, and therefore they employ more. And this productivity effect more than counteracts the substitution effect, where you substitute machines for manpower. So the dominant effect is that firms that robotize, they have a higher market demand for their product and therefore they employ more. And you could see here the sales, again, the defensive compared to a similar firm that does not automate, the sales of the firm that automate goes up and the export sales of the firm that automate goes up. Okay, so that was the story in the paper with Céline and Simon and Xavier. Okay, and now what about AI? And so for the report we started, but now we've made progress since the report. The report was, handed over to Macron a year ago, and we've been working ever since on AI and employment. But to just introduce you to that, but Simon will go in much more detail this afternoon, we conducted a random survey covering 9,000 representative firms with more than 50 employees each. And we have even study comparing between firms that adopt some AI between 2017-2020 and similar firms that adopt AI. Okay, and what we find again, like with robots, firms that adopt AI, they create employment, and again, it's because of a productivity effect. You can see the sales of firms that adopt AI going up compared to firms that do not adopt AI. So the same applies to robotize. AI is the same story as robotization. By the way, that would explain why none of the previous technological revolution ever produced mass unemployment. You know, there was always a fear. When you had the steam engine revolution, you had the Luddites movement, you know, there was this fear of mass unemployment. When you had the electricity revolution, Keynes was predicting mass unemployment. And you never observed mass unemployment. Why each time? Because the productivity effect was at work and more than counteracted the substitution effect. Okay, so now the thing is that it's not uniformly, and Simon will go into details this afternoon, the positive effect, the effect of AI on employment is not uniform. For example, in particular, if you look at jobs that are widely exposed to AI, where a high share of tasks in those jobs are substituted by AI, and AI used for administrative purpose, if you have those three conditions, then you have a slightly negative effect. You see, so it's not a uniformly positive effect of AI on employment. But so what's very interesting is that, I don't want to go into much detail there, because I think Simon will know, there's been an interesting paper in International Labour Office working paper decomposing job into tasks. And you would put a low score for a task with small replacement risk, a medium score with a task with medium replacement risk, and a high score with a task with high replacement risk. And managerial jobs, most of the tasks are in the low replacement, you see. So but the ideal jobs are those ones, is exactly going to the first paper we saw today. So the boring tasks are replaced by AI, but managers can concentrate more on the more creative tasks, okay? But if you look at clerical support workers, for example, typists, travel consultants, most of the tasks are substituted by AI, okay? So you, on that basis, you would say, well, you know, those jobs are not at risk, those jobs are at risk, okay? And but there is a map drawn by Antonin, where, you know, when you move to the right, you go from jobs where a high share of tasks are substitutable by AI, and when you move to the right, you have a high share of tasks that are not substituted by AI, you see? And when you move up, it's low exposure, high exposure. So the worst part, the job more at risk a priori, as those jobs which are highly exposed to AI, and where a high share of tasks are substituted by AI. The Northwest, that's the difficult one. These ones, no problem, because they have low exposure to AI, and these ones, they have exposure to AI, but you think that most of the tasks there are not prone to be substituted by AI. Really, the dangerous zone is the Northwest, okay? Simon comes from the Northwest of France, by the way. Yeah? So you know about the Northwest, huh? Yeah, bon, Normand, la Normandie. Voilà. So accountants, telemarketers. So usually when we would face accountants and telemarketers giving this presentation, they would think that they have to kill themselves, essentially, or to look for another job. They think, well, God, it's finished. Well, I am in the zone. High replacement, high exposure, and most of the tasks substituted by AI. What will I do? But things are not so bad. So if you start from this part, you have accountants, telemarketers, and so on. So you would say, if you think in those terms, you would think that up to there, the jobs are at least 10% of the jobs, and as of here, you should be okay. But in fact, it's a very pessimistic picture. And what we do in a nutshell is to redo the regression of AI unemployment on each particular regions of this map. So for example, of course, if we concentrate on low exposure jobs, not surprisingly, you find no effect of AI on employment. If now you go to the Northeast, which are the jobs highly exposed, but where most of the tasks are not replaced by AI, but you find a positive, quoi. It's okay, quoi. You don't find... the big surprise, and Simon will be much more detailed on that this afternoon, the big surprise came here. We thought that if we would perform the regression of AI on employment, restricting attention to the Northwest, we would find a negative effect, but we find a positive effect. And why is that? Because it all depends on the use of AI you make. And in fact, you see, if you consider AI used for production process or ICT security here and here, even when you restrict to the Northwest, you find a positive effect. It's only if you restrict attention to the Northwest and AI used for administrative purposes, then you find a negative. So to find a negative is much less than 10% of the jobs. So you need to have highly exposed job, most of the tasks substituted by AI, and AI used for administrative purposes, you see? And there you are, you have a negative, okay? So what I would like to say, to conclude again, why institutions matter. Because I think AI overall has employment creation potential, but to harness the potential, what you need first is a good education system. You need educated. Why? Because at school, you learn to be adaptable. You learn to learn. It's important to have good PISA tests. Try to emulate no excuse charter schools in the US. That really work well. Give attention on basic calculus, on reading, on homework done at school, tutorship. Do whatever they do in the no excuse charter schools. And all the work, you know, there by Angrist is very, you know, informative. And we should emulate the example of no excuse. So we need, because they, you may have any labor market system. If you have a bad education basis, you won't go very far. So first, have a good education system. And on top of that, have the have a kind of labor market system that you have in Scandinavian countries. So we saw a very good example. My model is Denmark. Okay, so Denmark, Alexandra Roulet, you know, she did a very interesting paper on Denmark. When she compared the health, the evolution of the health of someone in a firm that closes down to the health of someone, in a firm that does not close down, okay? And what you find is that so it's a difference in difference before and after the firms close down, and I compare between the worker in the firm that closes down and the worker in the firm that does not close down. You see no difference in the purchase of sleeping pills and anti-anxiety in Denmark. Okay, so the fact that you lose your job in Denmark has no impact if you compare to a similar worker with similar education, experience, and age, no impact on the purchase of antidepressants and sleeping pills, etc. No effect on the probability of a circulatory system, and no effect on mortality. Unlike the US, where you know you have the death of despair, you know, phenomenon that Case and Deaton have pointed out, because there, of course, the social system is crap, essentially. We don't want the U.S. I love the U.S. innovation system, but I hate the U.S. social system. Okay. So the thing is that, again, institutions are important. AI has growth creation potential. But to harness this potential, you need a good education system. And on top of it, a good labor market system. How does it work in Denmark? Why do they have this? Because in Denmark, they have the flex security system. When you lose your job in Denmark, for 2 years, you get 90% of your salary, and the state retrains you and helps you find a new job. That's why it works like that. So it's both very efficient. It makes creative destruction work very well. And it also protects employees. And I think but that works also because they are well educated in Denmark. So I think, you see, overall, harnessing the growth potential of AI, competition policy in particular, harnessing the job creation potential of AI, education and flex security. So in both cases, technologically speaking, there is enormous potential, but all the challenge is on institutions. You need to set up the policies and institutions that will allow you to take the best advantage of AI. Okay, so, and the second, the last comment I want to make is usually you tend to oppose competition and industrial policy. I believe in pro-competition industrial policy. So I told you on competition, open source, ease data access, extend the Digital Market Act to the whole value chain of AI, avoid excessive regulation. All those things are important to foster competition in AI. But I also believe that countries like France and other countries should invest in local computing power, local data centers, to also help new entrants. And so I believe that, you know, usually people tend to oppose industrial policy and competition policy. I don't believe so. DARPA is a good example that you can have, you know, pro-competition industrial policy. And AI is an area where you can have pro-competition industrial policy. And so, in fact, I always end up with the Draghi report. It's very interesting with the Draghi report, you know. It's a very sad story for those who come from the US. I think with all what I'm saying today, I won't be able to attend the NBER Summer Institute. They will stop me at Logan. But it was a very funny story because Draghi produced a report where he said, you know, why is our productivity declining compared to US productivity? Why did we miss partly the IT revolution? Antonin has done very, very pioneering work showing, you know, all the facts. And what can we do to catch up? And we said various things, single market, a good financial ecosystem, support public basic research and the DARPA. And you see, I think Trump was so concerned for Europe that we were lagging behind that he shot himself in the feet. What will I do to reduce the gap? I will stab Harvard. I will stop funding basic research. You know, he's doing driving in reverse. Because I think he's a good man. You know, he doesn't like the fact that there is this widening gap between Europe and the US. So he said, what will I do to shoot myself in the feet in all those dimensions? To make sure that we converge, you see, I mean, that's anyway. So, thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.